Okay, so why don't we get started? My name is Dan Shim. I'm from Arizona State University. I'm going to give you a tutorial on equation of state. The theoretical part of the equation of state is really well covered this morning. Lars gave excellent lecture. So what I want to focus on is a couple of things. The goal that I have today is to have a chance to sort of like gain some more insights on what exactly those equation of state parameter means physically. It's sort of gaining a physical insights to those parameters, what exactly Grudenhagen parameter means and what exactly bulk modulus means, and how, what kind of influence that you would have if you have Grudenhagen parameter equals 2 versus 1 for the bulk sound speed profile, for example, or density profile. That's what I want to achieve in the first half of the tutorial. Second half of the tutorial is more technical, and I'm going to introduce to you a couple of tools that you can use to hopefully resolve some of the discrepancies out there in the mineral physics data sets using a consistent set of pressure scales. Sounds like very technical for a mineral physicist, but at some point, if you need to deal with physical parameters, this tool might become very handy. So hopefully I can have enough time. So I'm going to use Python, and I believe that most of you have way more experience than I do in terms of programming language. But Python is relatively new and it's popular for younger generations. So the scripts that I'm going to show you today is mostly Python scripts. So how many of you are familiar with Python? Great. Okay. Well, we have more on this side than this side. So those who wants to make a new friend in this side, and if you are willing to move onto the dark side, that would be great. The second component of my tutorial is based on Jupyter Notebook. How many of you have an experience with Jupyter Notebook? Again? We have more here than less, okay? So if those who have an experience with Jupyter Notebook and Python can move to this part, then help others to go through this tutorial, it'll be great, okay? No move? Please. Or some of you can move too, right? Now, in your virtual machine, you have basic setup that's supposed to work with all the tutorial materials that I'm going to share with you today. And I have tested quite extensively, and hopefully it works. So the actual material, which is script written in Jupyter Notebook, we need to download it now. So now go to the second step. Let me go through the steps with you now. So first go to your virtual box and fire up Decider 2018, right? We've done it before, or just yesterday, okay? If you get the login screen like me, then choose mineral physics and log in. Okay, and you're gonna see three different folders there. One is for the Burn Man, and the other two is for my tutorial. These are basically the detailed version of the tutorial material that I'm gonna use. I realized last night that I was too ambitious. So I decided to scale down the tutorial a little bit, given the fact that I have only 90 minutes. So we're going to download some files, which wouldn't take a lot of time. These are really small files. So what I want you to do is right-click anywhere in an empty space, not on the icons. You see Create New. We're going to create a folder. We're going to name it EOS EX. Okay? Now you have a new folder. Right? And please interrupt me or slow me down if in case I go too fast. Okay? By the way, I teach coding for undergrads. So I have some experience. And I have some patience as well. So if now we're going to click this EOS underscore EX, right-click, and there's a convenient feature there called Open in Terminal. If you click that, then you're going to get a terminal, and nicely inside the folder you just created. Okay, so you don't have to cd until you get to there. Now, I want you to open a web browser. Oops, sorry. Believe or not, we do have a web browser in your virtual machine, which is Firefox, I believe, right? Now we're gonna go to some website, github.com, shdshim. Okay, so this is my GitHub website. So you're gonna see a bunch of things. By the way, just a side note. This is a picture from 1950 issue of Popular Mechanics. At that time, people thought that by 2018, we're going to have a computer like this at every home.
Is there an image on you that make it bigger?
Bigger. I don't know how to do that in Linux.
If you go to the top right, there's a little rebound.
Top right. Yeah? This one? To the right? Okay. But not the address window, address box, right? Okay. So now we're going to click repositories, okay? And the first one you're going to see is CIDR2018-EX. That I created last night, and you click it, then you get this repository, and you get a list of files there. We're not going to download one by one, so don't worry about it. And now if you go down below, you're going to see README file of this repository, just in case after this tutorial, if you want to have Python set up, and if you find that, oh, this is going to be useful for me, I want to have a copy of it, and I want to have a setup in my host operating system, not the virtual machine, because I believe that most of you ended up deleting this virtual machine file because it's huge, right? It takes up a lot of space. So in case you are interested in installing in your host operating system, I'm more than happy to help you, okay? And if you want to try yourself instead of asking me, then I put down some instruction here. Okay? What we are going to do is go to this address box, and we're going to highlight that address at the top, and we're going to copy that. Okay? And then we're going to go back to terminal window. Are you with me so far? No?
What did you copy?
Address box. If you go to the top here, right, we just need this address. You can type in if you want, but most of you probably prefer not to type in this long address. So let's copy this address, copy, go back to terminal. This is the last chance for you to interrupt me for this part. Anybody? Yep. Okay, so that's totally unexpected. So the way we can do is you go back to your host operating system, okay, and open a web browser in your host. GitHub. Oh gosh. Well, you guys made a shared folder. So what you can do is we can download this package in your host operating system, and through the shared folder, you can actually send in those files. Okay? If someone can help those people who don't have internet connection, it'll be great. Okay. Let's go back to terminal. So what we are going to do is git clone, and then you paste that address, okay, and then dot. Don't forget the dot here. Are you with me? And okay, I'm sorry.
There are some people who are not with you.
Okay. I don't know why they don't have internet connection. The virtual machine has is made such that it has a connection through the but. So if you hit enter, then it's going to download a bunch of things, but it will finish pretty soon, because there are not many things to download. Are you with me? No? Yes? Okay, let's check whether you do have those files. If you do ls, this is going to show the files that you have just downloaded. Okay, so if you see this list of files, when you hit, put down ls and hit the enter, then you're there. Okay. How many of you are here at this? Okay, so majority of you. Okay, so now we are all ready to go. What we are going to do, we are going to use Anaconda distribution of Python. There are many different distributions of Python other than official distribution. Anaconda is one of the best in terms of scientific use, and I'm going to use Anaconda distribution of Python, which is already installed in this virtual machine. So to activate Anaconda instead of using Python that is native to Linux, you need to do this: source activate root, source space activate root space root, enter. And if you have done successfully, then you will get this little note here that you are in a base Anaconda environment. You are now successfully isolated yourself from native version Python. Yay! No? So now we're going to run the Jupyter Notebook or Jupyter Lab. Jupyter space lab. Okay? Jupyter Lab is like a next level thing compared to Jupyter Notebook. It has a lot of interesting, convenient features, if you're not familiar with that. Now, if you have done successfully, what you are going to see is that your web browser will come forward like this, with a file browser on your left-hand side. On your right-hand side, you have something about the Python compiler options that you have. Okay? Jupyter Notebook is actually independent and separate from Python. It actually now expanded such that you can actually use Fortran, you can use C++, you can use a variety of different languages with Jupyter Notebook. You're going to see how Jupyter Notebook look like. The first file that we're going to do tutorial together is this one, 0. Is it too small?
Yes.
Okay. Hopefully this doesn't mess up the settings that I made, but I'm gonna try. So display, let me see. Is it better? Is it better? Yeah? Yeah, this is better? Okay, good. So now we're gonna choose 0-EOS.IPython notebook files. Just double click it. Okay. Those who have an experience with Mathematica before, you will find that Jupyter Notebook look just like Mathematica, but it's way better. Now, when you look at it, it shows what language this Jupyter Notebook is written, which is Python 3. And now, if you look at this content side of it, you'll see this in an empty, you know, square bracket. And then you have some white area, and then you have some sort of gray area there and white area there. What is great about Jupyter Notebook when you do coding or scripting is that you can do both word processing and coding together. Okay? You can write an equation, you can make table, you can do animations, you can do anything you can think of doing with your commercial software, Microsoft Word. And this is better because now you can put code in it. Okay? So there are two largely different cell components in the Jupyter Notebook. By the way, I almost feel like I'm giving a Jupyter Notebook tutorial rather than equation of state tutorial. But once we go through it, we're going to play with equation of state. Okay? So anything that is painted with gray background is a code cells. Okay? So you tell Jupyter Notebook that I'm writing a code there. Okay? And anything that is white background is a document cell, or more specifically, Markdown cell. Markdown is a name of programming language that is just like HTML, but a lot easier to learn. And it also understands the LaTeX, so you can write an equation. Okay? So for example, if you want to edit this code cell, you just go there and click, then you will get this blue lines around it, which means that you activate that cell, and now the Jupyter Notebook is ready to accept any edits or changes or revisions you might do. Okay? Now, if you want to change a text, this is a text cell, you just go there and just double click it. Okay? And it gives you a cursor, and now I'm here, right? You can type in anything you want. Okay? For example, if you want to show sine alpha, I'm sorry, those who understand what this means in terms of LaTeX, you can do this. And then, here's a secret, you hold down shift key, and then press return. This is Linux. Or those who wants to use this icon, if you click play icon, it's going to transform this part into a document form with alpha. Well, later on, if you scroll down this notebook, you will see more complicated equations. Okay? Just a side note. 2014, there was an article in journal Nature that they want to ultimately go or move away from PDF to Jupyter Notebook type of documentation form. The reason is it's all about transparency and reproducibility. How many of you have a frustrating experience that you cannot reproduce somebody else's number in somebody else's paper? Yeah, right? But you are going to see that with this type of documentation, you can reproduce someone else's results right away because they have to. put down their codes in there and tables and everything. Number means something if you have a code. Number doesn't, may not mean anything more than just table if you don't have a code. By the way, so if you want to run whole notebook, you see this command tab? Click it, and you will see a familiar search box at the top. Now what you're going to do is restart, type restart. If you type that, there are three, it shows you three associate comments starting with that word restart. Okay? We're going to do restart kernel. Kernel means it's Python, which interpret your code cells and then run all the cells. Okay? Click it. And it will warn you that something is going to happen, which means that it's going to execute the code. You're fine with that, right? So you're going to restart, and what you're going to see is that this empty bracket now shows you numbers, 1, 2, 3. These are the number or order that is assigned to a particular coded cell. What this means is that it's the first cell that is internally compiled and give a result. This is a second code cell, third code cell. And those who are familiar with Python, you will recognize that I'm plugging in a lot of modules here, right? So Python, one of the versatility of the Python is that you can plug in a lot of modules, just like plugins or extensions in your web browser. So what I'm doing here is just make a basic setup for the viewing of the graphs. And this one imports many libraries, scientific libraries that I'm going to use. NumPy is famous for dealing with large size arrays. Uncertainties, this is my favorite, allows you to do error propagation properly. Okay? How many of you struggle with error propagation? Yeah. You sometimes think, oh yeah, my error looks like 1%, so I'm not going to go through all that rigorous stuff. I'm going to just assign 1% error for my final number. Okay? Those excuses are gone. You cannot do it anymore because you have tools like this. And PyTheos is the tool that deals with equation of state. And uncertainty has many sub-packages. I'm actually importing different sub-packages under uncertainties. If you are interested in uncertainties, Python package is simple. Go to Google, type in uncertainties and Python. You will get the module. Okay? Now, if you scroll down, Lars this morning tell us about how to break down total pressure into the two components. By the way, this is LaTeX. If you double-click it, you will see the inside of that document cell, and that has, those who are familiar with LaTeX, yeah, here you have it, LaTeX. Can you do bibliography? Yes. You can do anything that you can do with LaTeX because it's essentially understand the LaTeX. But anyway, more important thing is not a Jupyter notebook. That's equation of state for us. So we breaks down the pressure term into two. This is we call total pressure. This is we call static pressure. And this is thermal pressure. I forgot, probably intentionally, to put down the subscript there. If you double click it, you go here, and if you do underscore and total, and if you go here and static, so this is a total pressure, and this is a static pressure. Okay? What static pressure means is that, as Lars told us this morning, it is a lot easier for experimentalists to measure the compressibility of materials at fixed temperature at different pressures. Okay? What this term describes is the compressional behavior of material at reference temperature, which is normally 300K. Make sense? Okay? And then the second term that you're looking at here is a thermal pressure term. So for the Earth interior, we want to know the property of materials something other than 300K. 300K is not so much interesting to us. We want to know the physical properties at 2000K, for example, right? Anybody know the pressure at the 660K? kilometers of a depth?
24.
Coulmental boundary? Yeah, yeah. So if you keep those numbers in your mind, it'll be easier to follow the instruction tutorial today, because we're going to use pressure rather than depth. So, you know, now you may ask yourself during the tutorial this morning, although Lars actually gave some clear explanation on the reason for the way we write the equation of state, but you may wonder why we express pressure as a function of volume and temperature rather than volume as a function of volume as a function of temperature and pressure. Does anybody doubt about it or wonder about it? Or this is more natural form to you? My question is, why do we write pressure as a function of volume and temperature rather than writing volume as a function of pressure and temperature? Which one makes more sense or more intuitive to you? Or you don't care? Yeah, right? In the lab, pressure and temperature is the variable that you control. And it feels more like density or volume is a consequential change by, you know, rotating temperature and pressure knobs, right?
The thing here, yeah, about this, though, Dan, I guess, is that the pressure, thermal pressure, is a consequence of increasing temperature but making sure that the volume doesn't change. And so in a lab, if you're doing an experiment, would that actually take place?
In the lab, actually, we change pressure to measure the volume. So it's actually not sort of fit to the basic concept of running experiment either. So in fact, when the equation of state was first developed, people tried to describe volume as a function of pressure and temperature, but they failed miserably because it's very difficult to write an equation that way. What people ended up finding is that if you take a first derivative of Helmholtz free energy, that is a function of volume and temperature, then you get pressure. Okay? All right. So we're going to break down into static part and thermal part, and the second section of the notebook shows Birch-Monahan equation of state at fixed temperature, so it's isothermal equation of state. You can write a adiabatic equation, adiabatic version of Birch-Monahan equation, but we're going to focus on isothermal form. And it's got pretty complicated form. It's not an easy equation to memorize. So I don't recommend you to memorize this equation. But what is important to know is that this pressure, this function, is pretty handy for us, because what you need to know as an input material constant is K sub naught, which is bulk modulus at reference pressure temperature conditions, in our case 300 K 1 bar, and K prime, which is pressure derivative of bulk modulus. Okay? Bulk modulus changes with pressure. What is bulk modulus, by the way? Do you know what this is? What's the unit of bulk modulus?
GPA.
Why? It is pressure unit. Why do you use pressure unit for the material constant? Anybody? So it's my way of thinking about this is that it's a material's resistance to the outside stress. So if you have high bulk modulus, which means that that material can have more capability of resisting higher, you know, stress. Okay? So in other words, it's amount of stress you have to apply to make certain fraction of volume decrease. Okay? So it's actually not exactly inverse of compressibility, but conceptually it's sort of inverse of compressibility. Okay? Would bulk modulus increase or decrease with pressure in general? Increase, right? Materials get stiffer and stiffer. Okay? So we have two parameters that describes the physical property of material. Oh, that's nice. And now you're going to see this normalized volume. This is really handy because you don't have to worry about unit of volume measurements. I'm not advocating use of non-dimensional number in mineral physics, but nevertheless, it makes your life easier. So now we have these numbers. So what this cell does is, those who have an experience with any computer language, this one, what is your guess? Generate number between 1 and 0.75, 21 numbers, an array, and give it back to Ada, right? So this is literally V over V naught. V naught is room pressure volume. So if you, you know, apply stress to your material, then, you know, volume will decrease. You're not going to have, you know, volume larger. Well, sometimes, very rare, this one gets larger than V naught at high pressure. So we generate those fractions there. And then we need some material constant to get the calculation. So V naught is volume at 1 bar and 300 K. And K naught is bulk modulus. In this notebook, I am using physical parameters of bridgmanite. Okay, so the bulk modulus of bridgmanite is roughly 260, and K prime is 4. Right? So far, so good? Really? Have no question?
What are the volume units for size volume?
Okay, so yes, right. I was waiting for that question. There was a second question that I was waiting too. Yes? Yes, that's a good question. I didn't think about that question, but third one. I'm still waiting for that one question. Why does it have two numbers? It's an uncertainty. This is actually excellent part of this package that I'm using, that it deals with uncertainty. So you assign an uncertainty and a nominal value, and U float means uncertainty float format, okay? So, well, why am I not assigning an uncertainty for V naught? Because we know really accurately. Okay, this is what we're confident of. So it's meaningless to assign an uncertainty because the uncertainty is so small compared to others. What is ace of cube, which is actually angstrom? So that's, well, this example is developed for the mineral physicist. And mineral physicist, we get volume through mostly X-ray diffraction that measures atomic distances. So angstrom 10 to the minus 10 meter is very convenient unit for us to use. But again, we don't have to worry about unit because we're going to end up normalizing it. What was the second question? Why is it 4? I want to know the answer. The reason is we have studied so many materials so far. Materials that are built based upon ionic bonding, if you remember that term, ionic versus covalent versus metallic, they are mostly 4. It's remarkable. And for most mantle minerals, K prime turns out to be like 4 plus minus 0.5. There rarely is something outside of that range, but that makes our life even more easier if you look at this equation. Xi is 4 minus K naught prime. And if K naught prime goes to 4, then this becomes 0, and you don't have to worry about this term. Beautiful, isn't it? I don't know the reason, though. So now we are going to calculate volume, absolute value. And this shows, you know, how to propagate the uncertainty, eta times V naught, then you're going to get absolute volume. And this is uncertainty assigned to each different volume in the array. And then EOS package, PyDEOS, has a Birch Monahan function built already inside of it. What you have to provide is a volume that contains an array of numbers, a range of numbers that you want to calculate pressure for, and then V naught, K naught, K naught prime, and then this is the number that you get. So intrinsically, PS sub ST, which is defined as a number with uncertainties or array with uncertainties, have naturally uncertainty propagated and calculated and properly saved there. So you automatically get it without worrying about it. Okay? The reason that I want to emphasize the uncertainty aspect of it, when you use program like Berman, which is fantastic, you often forget that those numbers come with uncertainties. You might think that, oh yeah, that I found that there's a 1% difference in my calculation by changing the amount of water. Then you have to second guess whether there's an impact from uncertainty, right? Whether the difference that you see is really significant if you consider the uncertainty. So that's what I want to emphasize to think about. Yeah. No, nothing.
Nothing.
It actually uses uncertainties package, yeah, to calculate it.
So, but PyTheos still has to somehow say, I want to, for example, do a derivative of this number?
Well, uncertainties take care of all those derivatives automatically.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that the convenience of that?
The errors are symmetric, which means that it's probably calculating the uncertainties in a very specific way. You can imagine taking
Right. There are asymmetric uncertainties, but for the numbers that we deal with, they are symmetric. So now this part actually plots. So we take just nominal value parts of P underscore, you know, static pressure, and we take out the nominal value part of the volume, because this number consists of two parts, uncertainty and the nominal value. To plot it, we need to take them out, and then we separately assign the standard deviation part of that array and standard deviation of that array, and then assign them as an error bar. Then your Python plots this uncertainty together with the value. Okay? So you can see that the couple of things that you can learn from this simple diagram. If you look at the pressure range, which ranges from 0 to 125, you see about volume change from 163 to 120. So, did I tell you about the pressure at the Kolmogorov boundary? What was it? 136. It's just about here. So, in fact, from room pressure to the pressure of the Kolmogorov boundary, how much of a volume change do you have for the Bridgmanite? It's about 25%, which is fairly large, right? Yeah. So now, now the exercise that I want you to do is, now I provide you with all the scripts here. What I want you to do is to perturb the numbers that I gave you, 260 and 4, bulk modulus and pressure derivative of bulk modulus, which you can find in this cell. No, here. So let's say I want to put like a really low number, such as magnesioworcestite or ferroperoxide. Anybody know the bulk modulus of magnesioworcestite or ferroperoxide? It's actually really low compared to bridgmanite. You'll be surprised. It's 160, right? So think of this. You have mantle, lower mantle, made up of two minerals with really different bulk modulus. In some sense, we are lucky, because if magnesioworcestite and bridgmanite would have similar bulk modulus, it would have been very difficult to use bulk sound speed or P wave S wave to constrain the composition, magnesium to silicon ratio of the lower mantle. Right? So let's put down 160. I know this is wrong, because then you also need to change V naught, which is you know. But I want you to sort of like see how things change. So once you change the number, play. Just press the play button. Then it'll update the numbers down there. And then play this graph. Well, unfortunately, you have no lines to compare to, right? The change. So what I would suggest is, those who are familiar with programming language, what you need to do is just copy these three numbers and put down there, Linux. That's interesting. Oh, yeah. It's not Alt or Command. It is Control, right? Control C, Control V, right? So now I am just copying the same thing, and I want to put the number back to 60. Now I want to put down like 160 is probably a little too low. Well, if you put some type of cation in bridgmanite, it is known to decrease bulk modulus as low as 240, whether you agree with that or not. Let's say it may happen. So let's generate a second pair of numbers like this. And now you want to change the name for that. Let's say perturbed for that. Control C. Now you're doing Python programming. Is that great? Right? You don't have to start from scratch. You stole somebody else's code and then copy and paste and change. That's not too bad, right? That's a permissible way to do it, because that's why we love open source softwares, because we share code, we share ideas, and you build from somebody else's idea as long as you give a credit to them, right? So now we're going to play this one. So now we have generated three set of new parameters there. So now the volume wouldn't change. We will use the same volume. Now we want to have a second static pressure term. So let's say PTR, and instead of these bridgmanite ones, I'm going to change to perturbed parameters there. And you don't have to print, but what matters for us is to plot that new value. So Control C, Control V, and now you do perturbed one. And same volume, right? And then for the error, perturbed one. So what changes is the pressure, not the volume. Volume, again, is an input parameter, right? Independent variable. Pressure is a dependent variable. We change the physical parameter of the bridgmanite, and we plot them together. Now you should be able to see two lines like this. The orange is the one that you perturb. In my case, I decrease the bulk modulus, right? From 260 to 240. And the blue line that you are seeing here is the compressional curve of bridgmanite. Are you doing okay? Or do you want to see the cells above? Just to see what I've done? Okay. I'll give you 5 minutes or 2 minutes. If you have a question, just raise your hand. I'm going to go around and help you out. Yep. I don't know, you can stay there. Yep. MP is not defined. Okay, so you have to execute from the beginning. Okay, whenever you, the reason is escape and why. You accidentally changed the cell to the documentation cell.
Right.
So
how do you do that?
The way you can switch between documentation cell and the code cell is press escape, and M will make documentation cell, and escape Y will make it code cell, so you can execute it. Yes?
I can't get to the red patch because I tried to do this, but it's giving me this last time.
Activate. That's strange. Are you in the virtual machine?
Yeah.
Are you in the, no, you're in geodynamics. You have to be in mineral physics. Yeah. Raise your hand if you have a question. I can move around, yes. So feel free to change the number and see what happens. Of course, if you reduce the bulk modulus, your compression curve goes to the lower number in terms of volume, right? Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, I'm sure at some point I just...
Yeah. So volume, you don't have to redefine the volume. You're going to use just volume.
Oh.
Yeah, because volume is input parameter. We don't want to change the input parameter. Yes. Okay, so far so good, right? No? I'm the only one who's good?
K is different by 20, and your error bar is only 3, the high pressure.
No, this is a compositional effect. This is a compositional effect. When you change composition, bulk modulus respond.
Yeah, but...
Yeah. Well, what
looks like
I...
Error
yeah.
Is small on K, but
right, right. That error bar is assigned for particular composition. You know what I mean? So some of us used to believe that aluminum reduced the bulk modulus of Bridgmanite. And that's what we are simulating now.
It was a comment that the error bars almost meet up. So it's quite depressing to work with that sort of
thing. Oh, yeah. Well, I know. So then ignore it. Yeah, so yeah, you're right. I mean, they're very close. They're very close. What bothers you most is that the yes, we can make really precise measurements now at 300K and one bar. Yes, that's impressive. But yes, Sonar is exactly right. No matter how good of a improvement you have, because in nature you are extrapolating your data to high pressure, so your error bar becomes larger and larger and larger with with increase in pressure. So, how does a mineral physicist like me justify of doing study like this? Oh, we want to study everything at in situ. Then we can reduce the uncertainty. Okay?
To what extent do then measurement uncertainties increase high pressure?
But that's better than propagated error bar.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is the reason why it is important to know how error is being propagated if you just rely on equation like this. It is useful, but you've got to be careful. Okay? And so there are a couple of exercises that I want you to do tonight. I know. You want to watch TV or have a rest? I know it's brutal schedule, right? 9 to 5. So. Did you realize that we have a lecture on Saturday? So, okay, the second part is about thermal pressure. Okay, this is really important part. Something that I want to tell you before we start is this diagram here. You're going to generate this diagram by changing the numbers and something, but let me explain to you a couple of things before we dive into this diagram, okay? So now, the blue is the compressional curve calculated for 300K, okay? Reference isotherm. The orange line here is, I believe it's 2000 Kelvin isotherm. Do you think it makes sense? The behavior, pressure, volume? So when you change temperature from 300K to 2000K, what do you expect for Bridgmanite? Thermal expanding, right? Thermal expansion. How do you measure thermal expansion out of this graph?
Top volume changes in constant pressure.
Yes. Right? Right? The gap between these two curves at fixed volume, fixed pressure, teaches you about how Bridgmanite expands its volume in response to the temperature change. That's simple, right? But unfortunately, that's not how mineral physicists look at this diagram. We love unintuitive way, so we look at the diagram in this way. Fixed volume and change in pressure. So the way equation of state, your equation of state and my equation of state, so-called Mie-Grunheisen approach, describe this, is that if you want to measure the pressure at this point, at this particular pressure at 2000 Kelvin, the way you compute this point is to compute the pressure at 300K first, okay? And then calculate temperature effect on energy, okay? And then convert that energy into pressure, and then add that pressure, we call it thermal pressure, to the static pressure. Then you get total pressure. Are you with me? That's bizarre, right? It's a really weird way to think about it, but it is really convenient, okay? I don't have enough time to explain why that is more convenient, but, you know, mineral physicists spent 30 years to find that that is way more convenient to do it. So now, but conceptually, if you think a little higher level, then it actually makes sense. So all this process is constant volume process, right? At this point, between these two, okay? So now, you are at 300K, you are at 100 GPA, okay? You have a box of atoms. You have a box with a bunch of atoms in it, okay? You are already at 100 GPA, okay? You are at 300K, initial condition. Now you heat up your material to 2000K. You're not allowed to make thermal expansion because your neighbors are all stressed, right? Your neighbors also wants to expand, right? So no one is allowed to expand. What do? You are thermally stressed, right? You're not going to explode, so don't worry about it. But you have to relieve the stress. How can you do that? You have to release thermal energy into stress, right? That's thermal pressure. So we need a conversion factor, a factor that allows you to convert thermal energy into stress. That's Grünheisen parameter that you learn in the morning, okay? Grünheisen parameter is a nasty thermodynamic parameter. I'm on record, right? So can we cut that out? Grünheisen parameter has been a headache for me throughout my career because it has tens of different definitions. It depends on which definition you use, you slightly get different values. Okay, there's an earth scientist definition of Grünheisen parameter, there's a physicist definition of Grünheisen parameter, but conceptually what's underneath of all this definition is a conversion factor. That's why some call it Grünheisen ratio rather than parameter. It's a ratio. It's a number, dimensionless number, that allows you to convert thermal energy change into stress when the volume is fixed. Now it makes sense, right? But now you can understand why Grünheisen parameter is important. No? That's another way to do it. That's great. I like it. So what we are going to do is to mess up my beautiful code with different Grünheisen parameter and see what happened to your compression curve. Hopefully that teaches you that the Grünheisen parameter. So let me give you an answer. No. Do you want to know the answer before you start, or you want to figure out the answer after calculation? Yeah, let's figure it out. So if you go up, 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 you see this thermal pressure, section 3? Are you there? You see those beautiful equations? They're all written in LaTeX. I'm switching back to Jupyter Notebook tutorial just for a moment. Right? Oh, that's nasty, right? Then you scroll down. I was calculating 2000 Kelvin isotherm, you see temperature term. Now I define here three different parameters. Gamma, 0 is Grünheisen parameter at 1 bar and 300K. That we can measure in the lab, okay? Yeah? But as Lars mentioned, Grünheisen parameter changes with pressure. We need to describe that, just like bulk modulus, where we needed a pressure derivative of bulk modulus, which is K prime. Do you remember that? You probably had a really nice lunch. Q is the one that describes how Grunheisen parameter changes with volume. Okay? Is that funny? Why not pressure instead of volume? What's the convenience of use volume rather than pressure?
That's your input, right?
I'm sorry?
That's your input.
Think about this. Grunheisen parameter, theoretically, for earth scientists, should be sensitive to both pressure and temperature. If you have to describe these two things into equation, you would need two separate equations to deal with separately pressure and temperature sensitivity of Grunheisen parameter or dependent changes, right? We don't want to do that. So what do? We make it so that it is sensitive only to the volume. Volume responds to pressure and temperature, right? So it is convenient. Behind it, there's an assumption of harmonic diagram that you saw. But anyway, so Q describes volume-dependent changes in Grunheisen parameter. You can see standard reference state value, and this is Grunheisen parameter at any given volume. V naught is volume at 1 bar. Q is the constant that describes the volume dependence of Grunheisen parameter.
So for this equation, can I understand the way that if, because pressure and temperature both control the volume, you can have a different combination of pressure and temperature like the same volume. Does this equation tell us that no matter what combination of pressure and temperature is, as long as the volume is the same, the volume is the same?
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's convenient. And the effect is small enough that we can ignore it. Okay? So what he was telling us right now is that the pressure response of the Grunheisen parameter and temperature response of the Grunheisen parameter shouldn't be necessarily the same. But we assume that they are the same because it is convenient, and the effect, the difference is actually pretty small within the pressure-temperature conditions that we are dealing with. So it's okay assumption. So now we define these three values, gamma 1.5, that is sort of more or less accepted value for Bridgmanite, 1 for Q, also sort of accepted value. Theta 0, it's a sort of a critical temperature. If you think of atom as an oscillator, once you pass this critical temperature, all the atoms are pretty much activated for oscillations. 1,000 Kelvin. It's a unit of temperature. Theta is unit of has a temperature unit, which means that at that critical temperature, all the oscillators have been activated. Okay, so it sort of more or less follow the classic behavior after 1,000 K, which is good for us. Why? We don't deal with much below 1,000 Kelvin except for the slab conditions and stuff. Okay. So now you have these parameters. Now these are the parameters that I want you to play with. So we will do the same. We will copy these three lines and then we paste it. We will change their names so that we can have a separate curve. Okay? Are you with me? So far, so good. Slow down. I still have 30 minutes to go. Okay? Now, we need to make a choice. I don't suggest you to change both numbers at the same time, right? That'll be a little difficult to deal with. You cannot figure out which number actually influences the consequences more. So what I want you to do is to change Q equals 2. From 1. Okay? So go back to this equation. If I change Q from 1 to 2, what's going to happen? for Grunheim's imperometer. It's going to be really way more sensitive to the volume change. So let's see what happens if you do that. Okay? So we're going to play this one. And these two parameters, I can explain over coffee. So don't worry about it. We're not going to touch it. This is related to the crystal structure, okay? Or number of atoms. So now we're going to play this out. And then now, this is the part where we calculate thermal pressure and equation of state. And this is a function that gives you the thermal pressure term, not the static pressure, okay? And that thermal pressure is calculated for the volume and temperature that you give, and then V naught, gamma, Q, theta, and N and Z. We're not going to touch N and Z. We're going to touch only the Q. So the way we want to do is copy this line and paste it here. And then the value that we are going to make a perturbation, although it's only Q, let's just be consistent. So I want to do this way. Are you with me? Yeah? So now, the next cell, add thermal pressure and static pressure. So we need to make a new pressure. We're going to use same static pressure term, because we want to just highlight the effect of changing Q. Oh, yes. Thank you. See, when I talk to my graduate student before CIDR that I'm going to give a tutorial using Python, they told me that you're going to be embarrassed yourself. I'm not as a good coder as you seismologists out there.
We can show you an embarrassment.
Okay. I love that. So now, here, we are calculating thermal pressures based on two set of different parameters. If you actually, see? What have I done? Okay. Oh, thank you. So now, this is actually just thermal pressure numbers. Okay. No. This is total pressure. So let's print out only the thermal pressure because I want to show how big the thermal pressure is. So if you do that, you will realize that, huh, thermal pressure, look at it. So don't worry about, you know, output from here. You just worry about output between there. What do you see? Almost constant, isn't it? Right? This is for the, error bars, yes. This is for the near one bar, and this is for the value nearly at 125 GPa. Wow. The thermal pressure is really insensitive to the pressure that you calculate for the Q that is equal to 1. So now the next array, from there to here, where we calculate the thermal pressure for Q equals 2. Look at the numbers. What do you think? It does show the pressure dependence. So the Q looks like a small minor thing. You might think that the difference between 12 and 8 GPa is, it's only 3 GPa, right? That's pretty big difference. You're going to see it. Because seismologists, to get sound speed out of equation of state, you are taking derivative. So any small amount of change you make will propagate into your final value of bulk sound speed. So this one matters. And when physicists argue each other about, Q equals 1. No, Q equals 2. It matters to you. right?
So what is, how long do we know?
I think it's biased view, right? I think it's fairly well constrained now. It's like, to me, it's between 1 and 1.5 or even 1.3. I think error bar is 0.2 or 0.3 is reasonable. But then, this is the error bar calculated for uncertainty of 0.3 for Q. It's fairly large, right? Because you extrapolate the numbers. So now we're going to play. Well, now I should have one more line added to it, which is for the Q equals 2 line. So let's edit the cell, Control C. And I need to put perturbed one, right? And perturbed one. Let's play the cell. Now you get the green line. They overlap almost entirely at low pressure because gamma zero, gamma naught, we didn't change at all, right? So they should overlap each other, no problem. You'll see that effect. Well, you might say, oh yeah, that's within the uncertainty. Yeah, the uncertainty adds up because Q has an uncertainty, but gamma zero itself has an uncertainty, right? And they add up. So there are a bunch of things I want you to try in your dorm room tonight, if you still have energy. Now, the next example that I want to talk about is once you know how to deal with equation of state, you can do a bunch of things. Lars this morning shows you, like, you can drive almost everything that you want to know out of knowing equation of state. Okay? You can do it by using a pencil and a paper if you're a theorist and if you want to do sort of derivatives. Sometimes you're in rush, you want to just get a number, right? Then you want to do it numerically if you're a computational scientist or you know how to do Python. And with Pythias, you can do those type of calculation really, really quick. So you can get the numbers right away. So the example number 4 here shows you how to calculate thermal expansion, which influence the buoyancy of the cold and warm anomalies, or red-eyed or blue-eyed, in the lower mantle. Right? So we're going to do that. Well, it looks a little complicated, so I'm not going to go through in detail, but nevertheless, the beauty of using open source, you know, software or somebody else's Jupyter Notebook is that you can actually mess up with it. You can copy and change just numbers and see what happened. Okay? So what I'm showing you is more complicated form of equation of state. So now, those who are familiar with object-oriented programming, have an experience with C, this defines the equation of state objects for Bridgmanite, okay? And then it inputs the parameter for static and thermal. And you know what? There are actually many different forms of equation of state. For static, you have 3, 4, 5. The bad news is that if you plug in same bulk modulus and pressure derivative of bulk modulus to those different equation of state, you get slightly different pressures. That's frustrating. So when you read a paper and you find that, oh, this author used Vinet equation of state, don't plug those pair of numbers into Birch-Monheim equation and expect that it's going to function well. No. Okay? If you're a generous person, that 1% or 2% or 5% error is fine, do it. Okay? But if 1 to 5% level matters to you, then, you know, you got to be careful. Okay? And what it does is that the, in the end, what it does is that the, this is a pressure. The y-axis is a volume change, normalized volume change, for temperature change from 1,000 to 2,000 Kelvin. Oh no, 1,500 to 2,000. Okay? So this is sort of like related to volume expansion. What do you see? So if you have a slab, okay? Let's say you have a slab sinking down. That slab is 500 K lower than surrounding mantle, right? You measure the buoyancy using the volume different thermal expansion here, right? And you measure the buoyancy by measuring volume expansion at 125 GPa. Is it constant? It's decreasing, yeah? So even if you maintain the same temperature difference between your anomaly and surrounding mantle, your mineral wouldn't behave the same way. It's increasingly become less and less efficient in converting thermal effect into density difference. That change is fairly large. At the top of the lower mantle, it's about 1.2%, but at the bottom of the mantle, it's almost half. This is not new. People like Don Anderson, like 20, 30 years ago, found this out and then argue against sort of global mixing. But there are entirely other factors that you have to be concerned about. So this is not the whole picture of the argument, okay? But nevertheless, it's important to know that there's a pressure dependence of these physical parameters that you have to take into account in your simulations or calculations.
No. So why are there these different equations of state still around? Like, I mean, as a mineral physicist, you see these parameters and you are aware it's for this equation of state and I can only target it to this equation of state. Is it impossible to agree on a best one? Is it, or what's the reason for it?
I cannot change my kids, right? If they like to eat broccoli, well, that's really unusual. I don't want to change, but I cannot change them, right? If I cannot change my kids, what can you do to your colleague, right? So what is the best way, right? You can think about, then what is the next best way? And that's the tutorial too, but I'm hopeless. I don't think I can do it. But the Pythios, the Pythios is not actually for this type of tutorial. It's for converting equation of state, converting pressure scales. So like if people use different pressure scales, different form of equation of state, you just convert their numbers through numerically to the equation of state that you want to use and to the scale that you believe it is probably more accurate. This is not about agreement, this is also include the topic of agreement and disagreement, but it also is related to the fact that we have improved our pressure scale over 3-4 decades, yet some of this equation of state parameters were measured, constrained, based on 30-year-old pressure scales, because back then, those are the best equations of states. So now when you read the old paper 30 years ago, I'm going back to you, then, the difference that you see from paper like 1980s versus 2018 may not necessarily be because of the intrinsic difference of the measurements. It may be the scales that you use, scales they use and scales you prefer to use or recent literature prefer to use is different. And that's about the second example. I'm going to go through quickly about the second tutorial just to show how you convert those scales. And there's actually a fairly important issue that I want to talk about in the second tutorial. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to sort of show you how to change numbers, but once you get comfortable with hacking with these notebooks, you should feel free to mess up. You can always download my tutorial from GitHub site. I'm not going to get rid of that repo. So, the original is always there, and you should feel free to take it anytime and go back to original. if I can use 15 minutes focusing on the, I can address your question during the coffee time. So now what I want you to do is go back to this list of files, click D-Mental Boundaries. Okay? Let me give you a little bit of a background there. So, post-perovskite transition. That's what I want to talk about. So, post-perovskite transition has a fairly surprising property when it was discovered. Clapeyron slope. Do you know what Clapeyron slope is? It's a dP/dt over dt, right? It's the phase boundary property. And for 660, seismologists have seen sort of thermal response of 660 discontinuity, right? You probably heard about negative Clapeyron slope. And that matches the behavior of 660 fairly well in comparison with seismic tomography, right? The magnitude of the slope is about minus 2 megapascals per Kelvin or minus 3 megapascals per Kelvin. When post-perovskite transition was discovered, what was really surprising is that the slope, the magnitude, is really large. It's 10 megapascals per Kelvin. It's positive, okay? Yeah, it's not surprising to you because you're not there yet. So you're not in the community at the time, right? 2004. I'm too old, probably. So this is bottom of the mantle. So this is depth. This is outer core. So the boundary between outer core and the mantle exists at 2,900 kilometers, and this is temperature. And the dark line shows the expected temperature in the region. So you have adiabat here, and suddenly it goes up. Why? Double boundary layer there, right? There's a heat flux from the core, outer core, right? John is not here yet, but what he discovered is that, oh yeah, the slope of the post-perovskite transition is fairly large, so can post-perovskite boundary intersect the thermal gradient twice rather than once, right? What is great about that, if that really happens, is that you have potentially temperature reading at two separate depths inside thermal boundary layer with a good estimation of depth difference between them. So maybe geodynamists say, oh yeah, maybe not so much for the mineral physicist. But it is really important tool, right? Well then, the question to ask is that how good constraint do we have for the slope, right? Depends on the slope magnitude, your temperature estimation changes a lot. That influences the amount of heat flux you can calculate out of the outer core. Right? Are you with me? Okay. So this is the reality plot. Pressure is a depth, basically. Temperature. So I rotated 90 degrees just to make the diagram comparable between these two. This is the boundary in MgSiO3. It says platinum, platinum, MgO, gold. These are all different pressure scales. You can already recognize that it's messy, right? There are slopes that are really big. And there are slopes that are not that big. It's sort of like almost vertical looking. This is about 5, and this is about 13. It's more than 100% difference. See? Where does this error come from? I once thought that the equation of state that we have used and the fact that we all use different equation of state or pressure scale might have something to do with it. In fact, we find 90% of discrepancy can be resolved by changing the equation of state. Okay? To do that, you need to know which one matches which, right? You need to sort it out, those things. So the second example that I was going to touch is actually the Jupyter Notebook that we published together with our paper last year so that people can take our calculations and reproduce it and mess it up with it. So in fact, if you want to have more detailed information about how to do this type of thing, the example D have all the calculations we have done in a simplified form. And we have a paper in JGR published last year. You can actually read it and then compare it. You can play with things. And then you can, basically, what we found, let's go back to that. Yeah. This one? So this one was reported by Ono et al. In 2005 using Platinum Equation of State. MgSiO3. No, this is phase boundary, post-props guide boundary. MgO is the boundary determined by equation of state of MgO, using MgO as a pressure scale. Is that right? Okay, so I skipped some part. When we run this type of experiment, we actually mix gold with MgSiO3 together and then put them in a diamond cell together so that they are under same stress field. And then we go to the Kolmogorov boundary conditions and we do laser heating, assuming that the stress conditions of gold particle is the same as stress field of MgSiO3, right? Then you measure the volume of gold, and then you know the equation of state of gold very well. So if you know the volume, if you measure the temperature, then you can calculate pressure out of gold. Then you use that to draw the boundary. What I mean by saying MgO is that instead of using gold, in those studies, they use MgO. In these two studies, instead of using gold, they use platinum. So use different pressure scales. And obviously, that's the first-hand suspicions that you might have. They all use different equation of state. So would that be a problem? So because I don't have enough time, what I want to quickly go through is, let me show you this one. So this diagram here, if you go through all this calculation, this is boundary based on gold, platinum, and MgO. You see the platinum and gold studies, those two studies, the slopes are pretty similar to each other, right? It is the MgO that is distinct. But there's a second question. This is 125, 200 kilometer above the Kolmogorov boundary. That's where D double prime global average depth is. These two doesn't match. That's frustrating. But this one matches relatively at reasonable temperature, right? So that was a justification of using this one, although it looks abnormal compared to other boundaries.
Dan, is there any reason why you wouldn't use a couple of pressure standards in a single experiment?
Because gold and platinum may alloying each other. Yeah, I know. It's painful.
Which one is better?
I'm sorry?
Which one is better?
Which one is what?
Better.
Better? No one knows which one is better.
Yeah,
yeah, that's, the, yes. So you can answer the question about better in two different ways. One is which one is absolutely correct. The second way, if you don't have that absolute pressure, is which set of pressure scales match better than which other set of scales. You know what I mean? No, it's complicated.
Well, we went through this in 2004 with the 660, and this was a big issue.
Yeah, right. So let me put it this way.
We've done this in the past.
Yeah, so MgO and gold doesn't react. They don't react each other. MgO and platinum don't react each other. It is gold and platinum combination that reacts each other. So we have done some experiments by putting MgO platinum together and compare them, and MgO and gold together and compare them. And in between those separate experiments, you have MgO to compare with. So we were able to compare all these three scales together, and then we actually reconstruct the pressure scale, hoping that it actually brings all three lines together. What do you think? We failed it. Yet, there's an important lesson that we learned. Look at the slope. They're better. They're better match. Look at the difference between this one and this one. Okay? The scale issue may give you sort of doubt. No, that's not that really different. Well, here the difference is 6 to 13. Here the difference is 7 to 10. So pressure scale does have an impact to the problem, but it's not the entirety of the problem that we have. Okay? But, yeah.
The phase boundary between a bridgeman and a post process, because you know MgO is just like a
they put platinum together, but somehow they didn't use platinum. You're talking about laser coupling.
Yeah,
MgO doesn't couple with laser, and MgSiO3 doesn't couple with laser, so you need something else like platinum and gold. So they put platinum in their experiment, but somehow they didn't document platinum. Probably because platinum doesn't match the post-perovskite transition well enough to the D double prime discontinuity.
I wonder if these differences come from oxides and metal, because you can give very different oxidation state of the salt, and according to that, you possibly experience
oxidation state of
what?
These are metals, Mg, gold and platinum.
I mean, because MgO is the one standoff. I wonder if this oxygen fugacity
the oxygen fugacity controlled by what?
Controlled by the buffer.
Which buffer?
MgO.
MgO doesn't have a variable valence state. You need variable valence state to be able to control buffer and control oxygen fugacity. MgO has a fixed valence state. You need iron. MgO doesn't contain any iron in this case. Maybe I misunderstand your question, but to my knowledge, MgO doesn't have a variable valence state, and that doesn't allow you to exchange oxygen that freely with something like iron. So if you want to oxidize platinum, you need to have really oxidizing conditions, exceptionally oxidizing.
You would see it if it reacted
well. Well, with MgO, I never have seen it. With water, you can see it, but I bet they probably try not to load water there. Gold is stubborn. It actually doesn't react with even water. This is all free from iron. Yeah. So there's no exchange of oxygen to my knowledge.
Yeah. But then at the same time, there's still about 15 GPa of absolute difference that doesn't seem to go away.
Yeah.
So does that mean that if someone, you know, I could just go up to John and be like, you know what, there's no post peroxide in double prime, why are you even talking to me? I like
people do that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know what?
If I like platinum, I can just ignore the
right. So let me put on one example. We don't have a good way to measure absolute pressure at high pressure and high temperature. Shock wave is probably one of the few techniques that allows you to measure absolute pressure, but you need to do thermal correction. And sometimes that thermal correction, you saw that, it's like 10 GPa, that's a lot of pressure, right? 100 GPa, 10 GPa, that's about 10% of an error, that if you translate to the depth error, that is large. That is way worse than seismically resolved depth differences. So there's an intrinsic limit that we can do, okay? Well, so if you, so yeah, yeah, it's large.
Yeah, like really large.
It is large. It doesn't seem large. It is large. Yeah. There are a couple of things that we need to do better. If you think of this equation of state formality, static and thermal, this parallel shift, sub-parallel shift may come from static part, right? Thermal part controls slope, right? Because it describes temperature dependence, right? So the fact that we resolve slope problem more or less like 80% in this study means that we did fairly good job of solving that thermal pressure term in equation of state. Whereas it probably means that we're not probably good enough yet for controlling static compression. But there are whole other things that you have to worry about in the experiment. It's not just entirely pressure scale. There's an old rhetoric that we have, like thermal gradient, stress conditions. Yeah. So it's a challenging experiment. Yeah. So within the uncertainty, yeah, this might be the reality that we have.
I was just going to recommend this paper from Yimei Fei in 2004, where they did this with the 660, because they were trying to figure out which pressure scale was right, and so they kind of used the seismic constraints to figure out the pressure scale. So it's pretty much the same problem, except it's a bit better resolved because it's at lower temperature and pressure. So if people want to look at like how people, yeah. Again, it becomes a little bit circular. So
yeah.
But it was actually a problem in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
For
yeah, the thing that I didn't mention is 660. Multi-anvil gives constantly 60 kilometer lower pressure for post-spinel transition until this point. We don't talk about it anymore because there seems to be 660. So if you run multi-anvil experiment at synchrotron, pressure reading gives you roughly about 600 kilometers for post-spinel. Rather than 660.
That's exciting.
If you run lazy heated diamond cell, you get 660. That doesn't mean that lazy heated diamond cell is better than multi-anvil press, right? We may have a lucky case where two errors offset each other, whereas you know multi-anvil has one error source and it does not offset each other. But that's sort of like a limit that we have right now. So in some sense, you know, you have to be very careful when you try to resolve something smaller than 60 kilometers in mineral physics.
I do know some experiments that suggest that maybe the problem isn't as bad as it is getting better.
Yeah.
It's not published yet, so I can't say anything.
Okay. Hopefully that is published soon.
Yes.
Yeah.
I presented at AGU in my study.
Yeah. But we learn more. For example, gold is not a good scale, but gold has been used excessively, like exclusively for 660. But the reason gold is bad scale is that at 660, gold melts. When things melt, their volume behavior goes crazy. I didn't know until lately. Yeah. Gold melting curve, who cares, right? At 660. But gold melts at fairly low temperature as 24 GPa. I'm sorry about all these technical details, but CIDR is really good in this way. Like, yeah, they deal with this type of problem. Okay, all right. So, you know, when I read a paper, when I look at this result compared to that results, now you know, like, you know, how much of an uncertainty you have to have in your mind when you see those two things, like seemingly different or very different view, might not necessarily so for some cases. So that's the message that I want to sort of... Thank you. Oh, sorry. At high temperature?
It doesn't work.
Neon, part of neon is cold, and so I'm not a big fan of using pressure medium as a scale for high temperature experiment because it makes me nervous. Yeah. Something get heated together is better.